Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Russ Jennings, State Representative of the 122nd District of the Kansas House of Representatives.
And I believe may have been the person who has traveled the longest to get here, and we're going to cover that, but first the open. This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go. And joining Russ and me this morning in the KCUR 89.3 production studio is Stephen Caranda, who covers the State House for KPR and KCUR. Nice to have you back at our podcast table.
Thank you. I had a donut. I'm ready to go.
We are ready to go. Russ, I want to say right off the bat, is unopposed for his reelection to the House seat. So we're going to spend our time today talking not so much about the election, although we will a little bit, but what to expect when the new Kansas legislature convenes in January. And why Russ may want to be Speaker of the House. But first, my two favorite questions on State House Blend. Tell me about your family and your pets. And I'm going to add one more for our friends here in Northeast Kansas. I want to know about Lakin, Kansas, where you're from. Let's start with your family and your pets.
Well, let's start with our pet. Mr. Boots, the cat that acts more like a dog that raised my children and seems to have 99 lives rather than just 9. But I've been married 36 years to my wife, Judy. We have 4 children, 2 sons, 2 daughters, 1 son in Topeka, 2 daughters are in the Kansas City metro area, and the other son is back in western Kansas in the Lakin area and engaged in agriculture and livestock in particular. Lakin is a small town of about 2,500 people, located 60 miles east of the Colorado border. And it's a place I call home and have called home for over 40 years.
Wow. There's a lot that we have to talk about, school funding, taxes, maybe even guns. But I'm going to start with Stephen and see what's on your mind for Russ Jennings.
So I saw at a community forum a few weeks ago you formally announced or at least said that you would intending to run for Speaker. At this stage of the game, what kind of campaigning is going on for a job like that? I haven't seen a lot publicly. Is it behind the scenes kind of stuff?
Well, it's an inside baseball kind of story, right? I've been traveling the state the last couple of weeks, meeting with legislators and candidates to become members of the Kansas House, visiting with them a little bit about my vision for how the House might operate in the future, and getting to know those folks. This legislative business is it's a personal relationship business, so I'm attempting to strengthen my personal relationships with those that will be coming in that are new, as well as those that have been serving.
What is that vision you have for the House, possibly in the future?
Well, I think the time that I've been there, I've seen the House turn into a place where the voice of members has been squelched through the application of rules in a way that eliminates debate. And one of the most important things to me, and I think in a representative form of government, is that the members have an opportunity to speak to issues, to offer their insights, their experience, their expertise, and use a more collaborative approach to policy decision-making in the state.
I want to go back. I was looking at some of your constituent newsletters, and you were very regular in communicating with your constituents. And in one of the last, and I think it may have been the last that you sent out, you wrote this: sometimes being the voice of reason is lonely work. So how lonely was it?
At times it's very lonely. The process has been utilized to create more of an exclusive club. There were 63 votes available on many issues that were acquired through less than a robust debate process. So it really was a process of exclusion of those that maybe didn't share the identical vision of leadership.
The voice of reason, I want to go back to that. I don't want to leave that behind. I mean, that is a fairly damning way to at least hint about how the rest of the House works and some of your House colleagues. So I guess the question is, how unreasonable was it?
Well, I come from a management background, so our backgrounds frame how we look at things. And I, involved in management, it's about identification of problems, developing solutions, implementing those solutions, testing results, making adjustments. This process has been driven in a way that draws a conclusion at the beginning and then forces the process to actually embrace and adopt that conclusion without any real discussion. So it limits the number of people that are involved in that process. It intentionally limited the conversation and dialogue around big issues that our state is facing.
What issues?
Budget, tax, highways, education, you know, these are Medicaid expansion. Everything has been done to squelch an honest discussion about where the state is at and to have a conversation about creative and innovative solutions to address those deficiencies that exist.
Stephen, you're there every single day. What do you think about what Russ is saying? Is that what you observed?
Well, one thing I can say is what we've seen in the past, in recent years, has been that there have been enough conservative-leaning lawmakers that the conservative leadership doesn't necessarily have to take into account some of the point of view of some of the moderates on some issues, and especially not the Democrats on a lot of issues. So they've been able to do things like with tax and budget bills the last couple of years, really get them through with pretty much all conservative votes. And so it's pretty clear that's going to change, and that's one thing I wanted to ask you. No matter what happens this fall, Representative, it looks like there's going to be a lot more moderates and possibly some more Democrats. How do you see that those groups kind of flexing their muscles here in the coming legislative session?
Well, I don't know that any group will flex its muscles. I think regardless of whether I'm speaker or another candidate's speaker, the reality is there's going to have to be a process in place that people have faith in, that they can exchange ideas, and there'll be greater input. And I think that's healthy in the process. Much like it's not really good to have one party have tremendous control over the process either. I mean, politically, and this is where I part ways with some of my friends, certainly politically, you may be an advocate for having 100% Republican or 100% Democrat. But that doesn't bring in the opportunity for a real meaningful exchange of ideas. And we know in our jury system, we have 12 jurors in courtrooms because we believe that people from diverse backgrounds, evaluating the circumstances as they might be, are more likely to come to the truth of a matter. And I think the same can be said for the legislative process. It's the diversity and inclusion that will result in better decisions, and decisions that I think in the end the public will embrace and appreciate.
You think so? You're advocating for the notion that if everybody has some problem with a piece of legislation, you've probably created the best product possible.
I believe that contribution of many members will lead to a better product. Absolutely.
We have a couple other people who are either going to run or likely to run. That includes the Republican Majority Leader, Gene Vickery, and likely, although he hasn't formally announced, the House Appropriations Chairman, Ron Reichman. What do you see as a winning path to the Speaker? I think I see these candidates able to maybe come at it a couple different ways to get that job. How do you see the winning candidate coming out on top? What coalition do they build and votes do they get?
I think that each of us will have to build a coalition that's based and foundationed in trust. The members that exist today will have an opportunity to evaluate us based on their experience with us firsthand. And for the new members, it will be a matter of creating a relationship that is based on trust, that we can actually deliver that which we suggest will be our approach to managing the work of the Kansas House. And that's personal contact. That's what I've been doing for several weeks now, traveling and meeting with people, and I will continue to do so. And I think I should say, this is not about reaching some pinnacle in a political career. I've enjoyed a wonderful career to this point in time. For me, it truly is public service, and I think we need to have leadership that restores the public's faith and confidence in the process.
So this isn't a stepping stone because you want to be governor?
No.
You don't want to be governor?
No.
Who would want that job?
I who would want it next is really the question. I think they almost are guaranteed a single term if they're elected and then do what needs to be done to right the ship in Kansas.
You had a follow-up, Stephen?
I was just going to say, we were talking just a minute ago about how you get elected speaker. it's looking like we're going to have a majority of moderate-leaning Republicans and Democrats who, if they chose to join together, could block issues, advance issues, in theory, even elect a speaker. You know, in the past, we haven't seen that happen. I've had some people tell me it's a long shot this year, a coalition of moderate-leaning Republicans and Democrats. What do you think on that issue?
Well, let's make it clear to start with. I'm seeking a nomination of the Republican caucus as speaker. I think it would be very disruptive and perhaps more damaging to try to create a coalition that come in January and overrule the decision of the caucus in December. So I have no intention to pursue that path. I will work at doing this within the Republican caucus based upon the principles of the Republican Party. You get painted as a moderate or a conservative. Frankly, if you look at my voting record, probably in any other state, I would be viewed as very much a conservative voice. I have a voting history, I think, that represents that. But you get branded before you arrive. Before I ever showed up and was sworn in, I was described as a moderate, so that's what you become. But I certainly ascribe to the idea that we need to be thinking, intellectually considering the ramifications of the policy decisions made and their implications across the state. And if that makes me a moderate, so be it. But I'm not anybody's slave in this. I won't be told what to do. I will act independently.
I want to explore some of those things, some of those issues with you in a minute. But first, have you seen the ISIS mailers that have been going around?
I have seen them on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, you know, so here's one. And just describe to the folks that is a terrorist-looking person with an AK-47, essentially suggesting that ISIS is lurking around many corners in Kansas.
And behind that person is a windmill to kind of indicate that this is in Kansas.
Right, because not a lot of windmills, say, in Afghanistan or anywhere else. But the point here being, this was sent on behalf of Joe Scapa down in Wichita. What is your reaction to that? Do you support this sort of campaign?
No, this is fear mongering. And you know, we recently had an incident in the Garden City area where the FBI uncovered a plot to blow up an apartment complex that about 100 Somalians live in. Somalian immigrants. That's homegrown terrorism. Those were people that have lived in Western Kansas for the better part of their life. They're radicalized, but they're radicalized in a very different way. The truth of the matter, and I've said this on the floor in a debate, the terrorists win. Their whole method is to create fear, to change the behavior of individuals and nations. This is playing right into their hands, in my view. Why do we overstate the potential fear and threat that they represent in the state of Kansas? We certainly have to be aware of it. We have to insist that our federal government does all that they can to protect us from such harm. This is fear-mongering. It's the worst kind of political mailer, in my view.
But we had, I believe, Clay Barker from the state Republican Party told the Wichita Eagle that they're focusing on this because security is something that resonates with voters, he argued, and that's something that's on their mind.
And therein lies the problem with politics in some ways. Do anything you can to win the race instead of doing what you should do in terms of developing sound policy and allowing the policy decisions that are sound to win the day for you. And this approach really undermines, I think, the entire process.
You repudiate this approach? This approach?
I would not use this approach myself.
Yeah. I mean, this is the party, right? The party is behind this. Your party is behind this, and I'm asking you repudiate this sort of campaign.
I do not agree with this methodology.
Mm. Let's move on to some big topics that you're going to have to tackle, whether or not you're a speaker, because you are going to be in the new legislature. What are you going to do about revenue? I've heard a lot of people talk about, and I think closing the LLC loophole. That seems to be palatable to most.
But that won't do enough to fix all our budget problems.
There is the and there is the question. So where are you on the LLC loophole and perhaps having to raise taxes to have enough revenue?
Now, it's interesting that there's a correlation between the Supreme Court's finding with respect to school finance, equity, and adequacy. I think the same argument can be made for our tax policy in the state as a whole. Tax policy should be fair, and it needs to be adequate to meet the demand to provide core governmental functions in a way that they can successfully achieve their mission. We lack adequate resources in order for core governmental functions to meet their missions. We will need to make adjustments to our tax code. It's certainly a bit premature to say with any specificity what all of that might be, but clearly on the fairness side, I think the people of Kansas have made it clear. I think the politicians in Topeka who are listening have concluded that continuation of business exemption for state income tax is not likely in the cards. That will likely be changed. How that looks in the end, we really don't know until the process occurs. And therein lies the difference between me and, I would argue, others. I'm not about saying this is the way it has to be, and I drive everyone to that ultimate conclusion. This really deserves lots of discussion, lots of debate, lots of input, and an understanding of the implications of whatever decisions are made to come up with the best decision. This could be a balance of income tax restoration for businesses. There could be a personal income tax piece. There could be a gasoline tax piece. There could be removal of some exemptions on sales tax considered. There's a wide array of options that are available, and it's just too premature to take anything off the table, so to speak.
How do you see the governor playing ball on this issue, though? These tax cuts have been one of his kind of signature accomplishments, and he has really defended them and wanted to keep them in the last few years.
Well, if you end up with perhaps as many as 45 Democrats and maybe over 40 moderate Republicans, it only takes 84 votes to override the governor's veto. And the governor has repeatedly said recently that the budget is the appropriation process, is the responsibility of the legislature, sounding as if he would like to hand that over to the legislature in its entirety, and a piece of the budget process is the revenue sufficient to go ahead and meet those priorities as articulated through the budget by the legislature.
So am I hearing you're willing to butt heads with him on this issue?
Sure.
Am I hearing that you're open not only to closing the LLC loophole, which, by the way, in full disclosure, I take advantage of with some of my freelance income, but you're also willing to consider increasing the marginal rate in on the income tax side?
Yes, I would argue that what we need to do is step back and look at what the tax rates were prior to the 2012 tax bill. The point to measure from is from that point in time, not year over year, but look back. Any tax rate that is below that over the time ends up being ultimately a tax reduction for the people of Kansas, which is likely able to be done and still meet the requirements to meet core functions of government. I think we have to be open to having that conversation. Are there political risks involved in that? Certainly there are. But there's political risks in not funding education or not providing for a mental health system that's capable of treating those with severe mental illness or caring for the elderly, or cutting Medicaid reimbursement to the extent that you lose providers to meet the needs that exist there. So I think we have to rebalance this, and it's really, really more about right-sizing government. It's not all about downsizing. It's not about growing. It's having the right level of government to go ahead and serve in those ways that we need service.
I'm going to move on to a couple of other issues, but just want to work in real quickly. Where are you? Do you think that there can be some significant gains with the A&M efficiency study? Certainly Ron Reichman, that was his thing. He points to it an awful lot. Where are you on that? Do you think that there's some real money to be saved there?
Well, any money to be saved is worth chasing. Now, is it enough to entirely balance the budget? No, I don't believe so. But there were some really good ideas that came up through that process that deserve to be considered seriously by the legislature. I believe we have a duty, a fiduciary duty, and responsibility of the people of Kansas to be as efficient as you can be and still meet the core requirements of governmental functions. And there are some good ideas in there that need to be fully vetted and probably given serious consideration. But all of the savings, if it was all achievable, still is not enough to balance the state's budget.
And wouldn't come in right away.
No.
I want to move on to a couple of other issues. I want to start with guns on college campuses. I think as a new legislature comes in, it feels as if you're going to revisit that that issue. Where are you on that?
I obviously have a voting record that strongly supports Second Amendment rights. You understand where I live in rural Kansas, mm-hmm. that we love our Second Amendment rights. We love our hunting and sporting with firearms. I'm certainly open to having the conversation. There is a part of me that believes in very strongly in local control, and that the Board of Regents are appointed to oversee colleges and universities, that we should give credence to whatever their recommendation might be on this issue. I think we should listen to the students on the campuses. If they're uncomfortable with it, those are the customers. Those are the people that are there every day for their education. And if their sentiment is they don't want it, we should listen to that. This is an important issue. And there's certainly an argument that can be made, and we can probably all remember when we were young people in college. It's not a perfect environment to have dangerous items laying around, especially firearms. So I think we have that conversation.
Hunting and fishing aside, you have a background in law enforcement. Looking at it from that point of view, armed people, students, whoever on campus, in any public building, for that matter, what is your when you look at it through that part of your resume? What is that? What do you see?
When I was engaged in law enforcement, I carried a gun with me every time I went out of the house because I had a duty to intervene in the event a felony occurred in my presence. I've not carried a concealed weapon since the day I left law enforcement. I don't feel compelled to. I feel comfortable in my own skin. I understand there may be a risk in that. I'm not paranoid about it.
But some of the people who have supported the guns on campus say, kind of to that same point, people have this right to carry, and that shouldn't end on college campuses. I mean, what do you think of that argument?
Well, I understand the argument, but I also understand that government controls a lot of things because there are safety considerations to be considered. And unique circumstances at least deserve the conversation. If I don't wish for people to have a gun in my home, I can tell them no. While it may be a public building, there are lots of inhabitants in that public building. My sense is if the majority of the people that are regularly there would say, no, we'd rather not have this, that deserves consideration.
So we could have a situation if we left it up to the universities where maybe Pitt State and Fort Hays would allow concealed carry on campus, maybe some of the universities other wouldn't. I mean, that's an okay solution to you?
I wouldn't have a problem with it being less than uniform if they chose to do so and they felt comfortable with that decision, of course. By the same token, I think cities and counties should be able to govern their public buildings as well. The legislature, beyond guns, has reached into issues of local government at historic levels. One of the foundations of the Republican Party forever has been around the issue of local control. And we've done just about everything we can to interfere with local control, with local elected officials who are far more accountable to their constituents than state legislators are. And we need to stop doing that.
Sometime after the election, I think we're going to get a decision on adequacy from the Supreme Court on the Gannon school funding case. How hard is that going to be, in your view, to tackle with everything else that you've got to do in the new legislative session? Is this going to create a big problem?
My thought is, while we have a standing education committee that does all things education, it's probably a year that we need to have a separate committee that does just school finance and budget, and that we have it be a fairly large committee, something similar to appropriations committee size, with a diverse makeup of geographic makeup, school size makeup, spend some time at educating those members around school finance history in the state, review good practices in other states for how they go about doing school finance, developing a what I describe as a distribution methodology more than a formula to determine the expenditure, and give them plenty of time to deeply dig into this, and then to disseminate information as they gain it during the session to all members so that we can all be more up to speed with it. The best way to build consensus in the end is going to be around legitimate information and knowledge. And while it makes it a much messier process than what we've experienced in the past, there'll be more buy-in to the ultimate solution. And I think the ultimate solution will be fairer. So if the court comes in and says, you've got to fund higher or public education at a higher level than you do now, and they give some guidance on what that number is, I think we need to take it seriously. After all, it is the court of last resort for resolving questions with respect to our Kansas Constitution.
I have a couple of quick yes-no questions, and I want to get a final thought and question from Stephen. But before we leave school finance, I want to talk. Just want to get a comment on. You're going to have to write a new school funding formula. Conservatives have said for some time that they think that any new formula should have some sort of outcome-based portion to it. That is to say, that if a school district does better in graduation rates or something, that they're going to get additional school funding. Where are you on outcome-based issues or items in a new school funding formula?
Well, the statement you just made almost defies logic, right? So if you do better, you get more money. And if funding is correlated to a district's inability to achieve good outcomes, aren't you kind of dooming those districts then to a path of mediocrity? And that makes no sense. I do think you can build in an incentive system that incents performance, but you can't ignore the fact that student populations are very diverse and they change. What we've done, and I think what the data reveals, is that generally, most average students are graduating at a rate of somewhere in the neighborhood of 83%, 84%. It's the at-risk students who are really weighing down the graduation rates, and they're in the lower 60%. What drives that? Well, they need more engagement by teachers. They need more support through paraprofessionals. They need more support through counselors and those kinds of things. And what we've done is we've created an environment that supports, at least articulates, a desire to have all-day kindergarten, for example. But the funding for all-day kindergarten has been taken out of the column that's dedicated for at-risk students. So if we chose to spend $40 million or so to fund all-day kindergarten, arguably you would restore funds to the at-risk population that would allow for restoration of the paraprofessionals and other specialists to help move these kids up. This is going to be tough. There's a lot of resentment. Clearly, there's a lot of resentment around the Supreme Court. You know, my background includes a period of time with the court system. I have the deepest respect for our process, and I accept that while I may not agree with all decisions, I do accept that some decisions are final and that we have an obligation to go ahead and give credence to those decisions. We might not like them, but we still have to abide by them.
Is it fair to say that you were a fan of the previous school funding formula before we went to block grants, that you are leaning more towards that sort of formula where educators would argue, well, you know, the state has an obligation to pay the cost of educating students, and that includes special needs, transportation, whatever that is. So are you more of a fan of, would you be leaning more towards that sort of funding formula?
I think we made a critical mistake in repealing the funding formula. It could have been tweaked in ways to go ahead and provide the stability and the accountability that many articulated a desire to see. And what did we experience? A block grant program. You know, understand what that really was all about. It was constraining and containing ongoing expenses during a period of fiscal challenge in the state. It had nothing to do with really delivering quality education. It was to manage a budget. And now we've gone 2 years with a promise that this next session we would adopt a new process for funding public education, and there's been no conversation about what that would look like through the legislative process. We squandered 2 years of time deeply dig into this and come up with a really good solution. And now we will be pressed to do it this year. My biggest fear is there will be those that will advocate a continuation of the block grant to get more time to do a formula. And that's why I say have a special committee. All they do is focus 5 days a week, an hour and a half every day, just on school finance. We need to get this taken care of. That formula was not complex if you knew how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide.
Stephen Caranda, your final thought or question for Russ Jennings.
Touching on big issues like the budget, education that you were just talking about, taxes. We already had a legislative committee say we're extending the session next year to 100 days. The record is 114. Are we in for a major slog next year, possibly breaking that record?
You know, if I'm elected speaker, no. We would go back to 90 days. One of the truths about the legislative process is pressure. Deadlines drive that process. You've almost guaranteed a session of 110 or 120 days by saying it's going to be 100 days. We should go back with the idea that we get our work done in 90 days and that we manage the process in a way that that's achievable. I would articulate to committee chairman, that's the goal. We need to wrap this people's business up in the time that's normally allotted, and we need to be diligent. If that means we don't have pro forma Fridays and we actually work 5 days a week, so be it. And evenings are not out of bounds either. We need to do what needs to be done to get the job done. And let's do it. Let's get serious about it. That's my message.
Wow. Two quick questions. Are you voting yes or no to retain the Supreme Court justices?
I will vote to retain all Supreme Court justices.
And Trump, yes or no?
Yes, there's the honest answer. And I have to say, at this point, in light of the revelations yesterday, I have grown even more concerned about what might happen in the future with the Democrats' candidate and a renewed FBI investigation at this point in time into her email issues. It strikes me that doesn't happen unless there's something substantial there. It concerns me.
Okay. Gentlemen, we're going to leave it there. Stephen Caranda from KPR, always nice to have you back with us.
Thank you.
So, Russ, this is where we turn the podcast over to you, my friend. You're going to tell us what song is in your head, and that's going to be our walk-off music. What song are you picking?
I would pick the Roy Rogers rendition of Home on the Range.
He's campaigning here with his song choices.
I'm not so sure I can get through the rest of the podcast after that. So, Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our friends over there on UpToDate make a little room for us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Big fan of the Twitter? Bet you are. You can follow me. I'm at Sam Zeff, and my co-host Brian Ellison, who takes care of things over there on Statehouse Blend, Missouri, is at PTS Brian. Russ Jennings from Lake and Kansas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
I'm Sam Zeff. See you around the radio.
How often at night, when the heavens are bright, with the light from the glittering stars,